Well, good evening. It's great to be here with you at Bible Study. We are continuing our survey of the Old Testament, and this evening we're going to be introduced to one of the central characters of the Bible, the man to whom more space in the Bible is devoted than anyone else, with the exception of Jesus Christ, and that is King David. You know, that says a remarkable amount about someone when God has chosen to inspire more chapters, more pages of text about them than virtually anyone else. We pick up the story here in 1 Samuel 16, and all of the remainder of 1 Samuel, plus the entire book of 2 Samuel, is devoted to the story of King David. In 1 Chronicles, we pick up the story in 1 Chronicles 10, where we have a brief recap of Saul's reign and are introduced to King David, and the entire rest of the book of 1 Chronicles is about King David. Now, the portion that we're going to go through here this evening, which is primarily the last half of the book of 1 Samuel, deals with David before he became king. Now, these chapters are deal with the preparatory phase of David's life. We have the time of his choosing as king, when God chose him, inspired Samuel to anoint him as the future king here in 1 Samuel 16. And we follow on through this evening until the time of the death of King Saul. Now, as we are introduced to David, we find that David's life can be divided into three, into four categories, four periods, major periods of David's life. The first would be David the shepherd boy. David was guarding his father's sheep. We're introduced to him as the shepherd boy, and he, for a brief interim period, during this time, while he was shepherd, Samuel, of course, showed up at the family home and anointed him king in a solemn ceremony, but it was a family ceremony. It occurred inside the family home. Then we find a little later, David was not only a shepherd boy, but he was a skillful musician, even chosen to play for the king for a period of time. So the first phase of David's life is David the shepherd boy. The second phase begins with a crisis in the history of Israel, conflict between Israel and the Philistines. The second phase of David's life is David the hero. He went from being a shepherd boy to being the hero. He slew Goliath, and this immediately catapulted him to fame and recognition. He was a great warrior. He became the son-in-law of King Saul. He was a hero. This period of David's life only lasted a very short time. Then he went from being David the hero to David the outlaw, David the outcast. Now, he wasn't an outlaw because he had gone out and done bad things and robbed banks or committed all sorts of crimes. He was an outlaw because the king decided to kill him. The king was jealous, as we're going to see. This period here, the latter part of 1 Samuel, the latter half, makes a very interesting contrast between David and Saul. In reality, there's a lot of space attached to Saul in terms of in the book 1 Samuel by comparison with most other kings. And much of this, as we will see, There is a contrast between two individuals, and I think that there are several levels on which we want to study. One obviously is from a standpoint of getting the history and understanding the events and being able to piece together the story of the Bible, but a very important aspect has to do with personal lessons of life that we can learn. That's one of the reasons God devotes so much time in the Old Testament to the lives of individuals, good and bad. Sometimes it's maybe a half chapter or a chapter, in some cases several chapters, or even an entire book. But we have different aspects of their life, and there's quite a bit that we can glean here. David, the outcast, took up a goodly portion of David's life, let's say most of his 20s. David was on the run because he became king, which is the fourth phase, David the king. That's the way we think of him. He became king at the age of 30 and ruled for a combined total of 40 years, 7 years, 6 months over Judah, and then 33 years over all of Israel together. But if he became king at age 30, then that means that he was an outcast, as you put the story together, for most of his 20s. Probably was responsible for slaying Goliath when he was a young man, let's say probably about 18, I think, when you put the whole story together. The way we do that is he was not yet old enough to be in the army. And the age of conscription in Israel was age 20. And he brought food up from his father to his older brothers, who made disparaging comments to him about, yeah, what happened to the sheep? You're just up here to see the action, see? And they were sort of took exception to kid brother coming up there. So we would place him under 20. And yet within a relatively short time after he slew Goliath, he was given, he wound up marrying Saul's daughter probably within a year of the slaying of Goliath. When you put that part of the story together, became very quickly moved up and became a hero and a commander. So it would be hard to figure that he was any less than about 18. That would put him up around 18 or 19 when he married Saul's daughter. And as you put the story together, by the time he was in his very early 20s, he had had to flee. And so spent very possibly 7 or 8 years as an outcast, as an outlaw. And that, of course, is a very difficult time. You know, we go through and we read this story, and it doesn't take that long, even though it's one of the longer accounts in the Bible. We know how it ended. But, you know, David had to live those years just like you and I have to live them. And if I remember correctly, and I think most of you will agree with me, the 20s are not the most patient time of life. I don't know that a young man is at his most patient at that time. He is excited and ready to get on with life, you know, and he's in a hurry. It seems like patience is something that comes a little more with age, and you get things in perspective a little more. But a young fellow who's 18, 19, 20 years old, is not usually noted for his patience. David was anointed as king. Perhaps he was only about 15 when Samuel anointed him. This was a while before the incident with Goliath. We're you know, these are approximate periods, but I think let's say just as a general rule of thumb, it may be off a year or so, but I don't think, as you put the account together, that it can be off much more than that. So David knew that he was slated to be king. But if he was 15 when he was anointed as king, that meant Saul had 15 years of kingship left. Now, David didn't know how many years of kingship Saul had left. David didn't know how God was going to work out these things. David became became obvious that Saul was increasingly unstable. David realized that because there was a time in his teenage years when he spent some time at Saul's court playing music for King Saul. I might comment on that. What we find as we go through the story is as Saul became increasingly unstable, there came to, and this account is brought out here in 1 Samuel 16 in verse 14, we're told that the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. Now, you know, that is That's a horrible thing. You think about that. That there's the Spirit of God departed from him. And now he began to be plagued by a demon that was allowed by God. I think that's the sense of it. You know, it's from the Lord in the sense that it is, that God allows it, not that God is desiring to plague people with demons. There are a lot of things that are of the Lord in the sense that it's by God's permission. God allowed it. And Saul, of course, had gotten into a state of mind, as we saw in previous Bible studies, that increasingly hardened himself against being corrected and an unrepentant attitude. And there came this point when God removed his spirit. You remember in Psalm 51, that was David's plea to God after this sin with Bathsheba. Please, take not your Holy Spirit from me. There's no record of Saul praying that prayer. And Saul began to be plagued by this demon. He became increasingly morose and depressed and moody and irritable and just increasingly unstable. And it became apparent, this change. Now, it's interesting what they did. They sought out a young fellow who was a very skilled musician. David was evidently noted in the community around. Remember, he was evidently somebody who had seen him or knew about him, and that he was a very skilled musician. Now, what does music have to do with a demon bothering King Saul? Well, simply this. With music, you can set any mood or atmosphere you want. You know, you think about it. They spend big bucks in the movies to have someone, put a musical score with the action. And you can think back from anything from the cowboys chasing across, and the music that'd be playing in the background, and it's, you can just feel the excitement. You know, you're sort of charging across with them. And or you think of maybe in a suspense movie, the bad guy slipping up on someone, and if you stop and listen, there's music, and that music is heightening your sense of emotion and suspense, and you're not even conscious of it, but that music is having an effect on you. You know, with music, you can get people stirred up. They're ready to march off to war. They're so, we talk about martial music. Well, nations have known for many centuries, that music could play an important role. That's why armies have nearly always had bands. And they would have marches and bands, and people would be all stirred up. But you can put a baby to sleep with music, too. You can have a soft little lullaby and just put you right off to sleep. If we had some here and turned the lights down, I could probably put one or two of you asleep. Might put myself to sleep as well. The point is, you can create any mood or atmosphere you want with music. And David obviously played music that was positive, that was soothing, that was, that was good, that was helpful. It created a positive atmosphere. What it did was it affected the mood and the atmosphere. And there was a period of time when it was helpful to Saul. It put him in a better mood, and he listened to it, because the reason Saul had become so vulnerable to these demons was Saul was just becoming increasingly despondent. He was brooding. He was very insecure. He would sit and he would think about things, and he was just becoming so negative in his mind that demon spirits were certainly able to play on that and capitalize on that. And Saul was just he was suspicious of everybody. He was very negative. Well, David played this positive music, and it was light and it was pleasant, and the mood and the atmosphere in the room changed, and Saul got to listening to it and enjoying it, maybe humming along or something, and his mind got on other things. Now, that lasted for a little while. There came a time, because you see, physical help can be beneficial in a limited way, but if you don't take advantage of addressing the root of the problem, Saul never addressed the root of his problems. And so eventually it got so bad that even David's music wasn't helpful anymore. Saul became so morose and so despondent and just so negative that nothing was helpful. But for a period of time it was. I think one of the things that ought to come out of this example and other things is the realization of how important a role that music plays. And I think that we're going to see increasingly that a lot of the problems, a lot of the youth problems we're having in this country and some of the crazy things that are happening in the schools, the extent to which a lot of that goes back to a lot of this demonic music that has gotten worse and worse. I mean, it's been building for decades, but it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And you can't sit around and listen to that stuff and not be affected by it. You know, people say, oh, you know, we're not affected by what we see on TV. Well, why do people spend millions of dollars in advertising if they don't think that what you see on television will affect you? Coca-Cola thinks what you see on television will affect you. They spend millions of dollars every year. If they didn't think it affected you, they'd save their money. I mean, all these places, you know, it's crazy when you think about it. But anyway, that's so much for that. As we come here through 1 Samuel 16, one of the things we see, God told Samuel, he said, how long are you going to mourn for Saul? I've rejected him. Fill your horn with oil, and I'm going to send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite. I've provided a king among his sons. Now, notice what Samuel said. Verse 2, Samuel said, how can I go if Saul hear it? He will kill me. This is verse 2 of 1 Samuel 16. This shows how far Saul had gotten. You know, Saul was so far off the track that Samuel knew Saul wouldn't hesitate to kill him if he thought, you know, this was going to protect him. Saul had lost so much respect for the office that Samuel had. You know, Samuel was the one that had brought Saul along, that had always been there to help him, that had made him king. And yet Saul was so far gone that Samuel said, you know, he would kill me if he knew what I were going down there for. So he went ostensibly for another reason. Now God, I think it's interesting, you know, God told him, he said, I want you to go to Bethlehem. I want you to go to the house of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, one of his sons. Now, if God had given him all that information, he could have very easily at the same time told him which one of the sons. You know, he narrowed it down to go to the right house. Then Samuel had to have all of the sons come before him one by one. God could have easily told him which one to start with. Clearly, there was something God wanted him to learn, and since he wrote it down, obviously something he wants us to learn. You know, when Samuel saw the first son, in verse 6, Eliab, he said, surely, this is the Lord's anointed. When he looked at him, he was evidently a very impressive looking young man. He was handsome, he was big, he looked just like a king, because God told him, verse 7, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I've refused him. The Lord sees not as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. You know, one by one, the sons of Jesse came before Samuel, and Samuel was impressed with each of them. And it wasn't any of them, of the seven that came before him. Now, I think God wanted to drive that lesson home. Samuel, if I had let you make the choice, you'd pick that one, wouldn't you? Well, yeah, you know, you can just, boy, just the way he carries himself, and he just, you know, his look and his size and his build and his face and his expression and all of the things. See, the outward things. And God let him go through the whole list and wasn't any of them. And Samuel was sort of perplexed because he had asked Jesse to bring in his sons, see, and so he had gone through seven. He thought, well, wait a minute, God said it was one of his sons. So he asked Jesse, he said, you don't by any chance have another son, do you? Oh, well, yeah, I got one. You know, the kid, he's out in the field with the sheep. I didn't figure, you know, we needed to bring him in for this. Well, we're not going to sit down and eat until he gets here. You know, go get him. And so here David comes in, and this is the one. And God says, you see, you're looking on the outward appearance. I'm looking on the heart. You know, I think if any of us had been asked back a number of years ago to make up a list of folks who would stick with, if a crisis in the church came, who do you think would stick with the truth? And who would abandon the truth? I don't think your list would have been a whole lot more accurate than mine. You know, most of us, if we look back to a period of maybe, 8, 9 years ago, and we've been asked to make up the list, it probably would not look like a list of, you know, who we meet with over there and in the autumn leaves, would it? God looks on the heart. God sees things you and I don't see. And always down through time. I mean, we look back at some of the ones who have been ordained and who have been set in great office. And then look, did they have the heart of a king? They may have had the look of a king. They may have been impressive, and they may have been dynamic and had a great voice and had all these things. But you know, there's an important lesson here for us to learn. Because what God is after most is the heart of a king. That's what David had. And God worked with him through circumstances. I think it is good to go through and look at the life of David and look for what were the qualities that impressed God with David. Because God had obviously seen qualities in David that he had a very positive approach on. Well, anyway, as the story goes on, we find that David did a brief stint at the court of King Saul, and we don't know exactly how long this went on, but this partly explains the situation that you may have had a lapse of a certain period of time here that because when David went back and was away from here, the Philistines gathered their army together to battle, and we find that there was a challenge that was made by the Philistine champion. His name was Goliath, and he was a huge man, 6 cubits and a span. Well, 6 cubits at the smallest measure of a cubit would still be about 9 feet. A cubit can vary from about 18 inches to about 24 inches. Goliath had to have been at least 9 feet. May have been taller than that. We don't know exactly which cubit was in use. But anyway, you want to figure it, he was a mammoth, mountain of a guy. Just huge. And he had armor that matched his size. And it was, you can imagine how heavy it was. Of course, you can think, you know, if Goliath was that tall, how much did he weigh? The indication is he was a big, powerful man. I mean, he weighed, you know, several hundred pounds easily. You can figure probably at least 500, 600 pounds, you know, just you think about, you know, great big a great big fellow, probably close to somewhere around 500 pounds, just a massive mountain of a man. And you can imagine how intimidated everybody was. All he had to do was come out and say, I'll fight any one of you. Well, nobody wanted to tackle him. And this went on for 40 days. And he challenged the armies. And this went on. In the meantime, Jesse had told David in 1 Samuel 17:17 to take some food up to the to his brothers. So David rose up early and went. And when he got there, he heard Goliath. And his response was, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should challenge the armies of the living God?" That's brought out in verse 26. You know, David, we see right here a couple of characteristics that come out. They sort of go hand in hand together: faith and courage. You know, David's response was totally different than anybody else in the army. Because after all, the rest of them had almost 6 weeks to do something. But David heard it. The very first thought he had was, who does that guy think he is? Doesn't he realize that he's challenging the living God? Why, this is God's army. Now, you know, everybody else hadn't been focused on that. So it shows us something about David. Now, this is part of why he was a man after God's own heart. Well, you remember the story. David said, look, I'll go down there. I'm not afraid of him. So word came to Saul that there had been a volunteer. In verse 32, David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said, "You can't do that. Why, you're not able to go up against him. You're just a youth. He's been a man of war from before he was your age." And David told Saul, he said, "Well, look," he said, I understand what fighting is. I keep my father's sheep, and a lion and a bear came in at different times and took a lamb. And I went after him, and I killed them both." And he describes the circumstances. Now, David didn't say, you know, "I got way off. I had my 30-06, and I got him in the scope, and I got him, you know, long ways away." Well, David didn't have that. He went chasing after him, grabbed a hold of him, and handled it right there with a knife, with whatever weapons that he had right there close at hand. And it shows, you see, David was clearly one who took his responsibility very seriously. And he was not going to be intimidated into backing off on something that he felt was his duty. Now, you know, God looked at that. Now, there's something. There's a quality for a king. A king who's not going to be intimidated into backing off what's right. If a man like that, when he's converted, if he has that sort of sense of responsibility for a lamb or a sheep, how much more sense of responsibility would he have for a human being under his care? See, God looked on the heart, and he said, now here's a man, here's a young fellow that obviously was seeking God. David talks about some of the things he meditated on, when I consider the heavens, the work of your hands, and all of these things. David obviously had spent a lot of time sitting out there in the open fields late at night, watching over the sheep by night and looking up and seeing the stars and thinking about, the God of Israel and how great he was. And God was real to David. God was real. See, he said here in verse 35 of 1 Samuel 17, he says, "I went after him, and I smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. Your servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them." Seeing he's defied the armies of the living God. He said, "Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." See, David didn't say, and boy, I'm so great, and I'm so tough, and I just went down there, and no, he said, you know, I know God did that. God delivered me. And God has blessed me in those ways, and I know that if I go down there, he's going to do this. Because this fella, even worse than a lion and a bear, he is consciously, actively defying the armies of the living God. You know, Saul was so impressed, it just sort of took him aback, and he stood there. Because here was Saul, he was the king. He was, after all, stood head and shoulders above every man in Israel. Don't you know that when Goliath was down there challenging him, everybody kept figuring, well, Saul ought to go out there and do something about this? Saul wasn't going out there. No way. He was getting close. But it clearly, what happened was so impressive to him that he said, well, okay, you know, go ahead. And David went down and he slew Goliath, you know, had the slingshot. And then Goliath found out the bigger they are, the harder they fall. You know, it just the fight didn't last very long. And David went and got Goliath's sword out and chopped his head off with it. And so we find in the aftermath of this that... of course, David was the hero. I mean, this was totally unexpected. This, you can imagine, you know, this had the whole nation on end for 40 days. And, of course, the problems with the Philistines went back further than that. But this was this stalemate. Well, David was the hero of the moment. And we find in chapter 18, this was the beginning of... a very close friendship between between Jonathan, the son of Saul, and David. Now, Jonathan was considerably older than David. If you put the story together, Saul had several sons and had several children. His daughter Michal was evidently about David's age, or she may have even been a year or two older, but she was not married, so we would place her around 20 years of age, something like that. But Jonathan was the crown prince, so he was clearly the oldest of the sons. Saul had, by this time, Saul had been reigning for, had been king for close to 30 years, not quite, maybe 30, maybe 27 or 8 years, let's say. Which means that he probably, his son was grown and was there were several children. So Jonathan was probably at least about 10 years or so older than David, something of that neighborhood. But they became very close friends. And Jonathan even gave David a present of one of his royal robes and some of his some of the things that he had. And we find that in verse 5, David went out wherever Saul sent him, behaved himself wisely. Saul set him over the men of war. And he was accepted in the sight of all the people, in the sight of Saul's servants. Again, you know, this would be something you would say of someone who is very young, and that they accepted him, even as young as he was. But he had done something none of the rest of them would do. So, and then after he had accomplished this one thing, any job he was given, he handled it so well, and he was just the whole way that he conducted himself caused people to really respect his maturity and to accept him, even though he was quite young. And after one of these forays, David had come back, and we find that there was music going on, folk songs being sung, and one of the popular ballads that had come out about this time was had the refrain in it that Saul has slain his thousands and David has slain his 10,000s. Saul heard it, and as you can imagine, Saul was not happy. Verse 8, he was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. Verse 9, Saul eyed David from that day forward. See, Saul was a very jealous and a very insecure man. And as soon as he felt like, you know, got any inkling that David was more popular than he, Saul became very uncomfortable, very angry about it, and began to eye him. He was out to get him. Well, of course, what happened as a result of this kind of an attitude? Well, this was like hanging the welcome sign out for the demon, because they thrive in an atmosphere of resentment and bitterness and jealousy and hostility and all of the negative emotions. Saul's life became increasingly eaten up with fear and jealousy and resentment. He became increasingly morose and bitter, and well, it was just, all those attitudes were just like hanging a welcome sign out for the demon, because that was, Mr. Armstrong used to use the analogy that Satan broadcasts. You know, he talks about like there are radio waves, and there's talks about, he would talk about how we could tune in to Satan's wavelength. You know, there are attitudes and states of mind that make a person receptive to Satan's influence, because that's the band he's broadcasting on. And if you're in that sort of a mood, you are receptive to any spirit influence that's being thrown out along those lines. You see, we can tune him in, we can tune him out. That's why they're positive things that help us become receptive to God and to God's, that we in a sense are tuning in that. Well, here David was playing and trying to create a good mood and a good atmosphere. Saul was past that point now. He reached over and picked up a javelin and just decided, you know, I'm going to kill him. And so he threw it. And David avoided out of his presence twice. Verse 11. In verse 12, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and he was departed from Saul. So Saul sent him out, you know, got him away from the palace, made him captain over 1,000. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways. The Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. He became increasingly fearful. So Saul's life is being controlled by fear and resentment and jealousy, a sense of insecurity. The very opposite of, you know, positive attitudes. Well, of course, Israel and Judah loved David. He was the hero. And Saul had initially said something to him because, you know, he had promised that if somebody would go out and kill Goliath, that he'd give him his daughter. Let you marry the king's daughter. Well, Saul sort of forgot about that for a little while. And Saul said, I'll let you marry my older daughter. And in the meantime, he went ahead and married her to somebody else. And but Saul's younger daughter loved David. And when Saul heard it, he thought, well, that's good. I'm going to use that to my advantage. So he told David about, you know, I'll let you marry my daughter. But what David said was, I don't have anything as a, you know, I don't have anything as a to bring as a bride price, as a bride's gift, and you know, I'm poor, and so Saul was waiting for that. He said, well, you know, really, he told his servants. Saul said, look, what you tell David is the king is not after a dowry, but he would like to be avenged of his enemies. What you can bring the king is 100 foreskins of the Philistines. You see, Saul's intent was that David in going out trying to do some rash exploit, would get killed. And then Saul wouldn't have to actually kill him. So he was. David arose and went, he and his men. He slew of the Philistines 200 men and brought that back. Well, Saul gave him Michal, his daughter. And we find that, verse 29, Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and he became his enemy continually. Now, it wasn't all out in the open yet. Well, as you go on down, here in chapter 19, we find the story of where this things had begun to build with David and Saul, and David had talked to Jonathan about it, and Jonathan spoke good of David to his father, verse 4, and reminded him of all that David had done, and so Jonathan brought David into Saul's presence, and things went on fairly normally for a while. In verse 8, there was war again. David went out and fought the Philistines, and they fled from him. And, you know, when David came back, verse 10, Saul sought to smite David to the wall with a javelin, but he slipped away. David fled and escaped in the night. And he came back home, and his wife said, "Look, you better get out of here." So they rigged this thing up, sort of put a dummy in bed, and she put off for a while. When Saul demanded David be come to him, David was sick, wasn't feeling well, and finally they came, got the bed, and hauled it in there. Saul said, "I want him brought even in bed." When they brought it in there and pulled the cover back, well, here it was, this dummy that they had made up. Now Saul was really mad, and David fled and escaped, verse 18. And David went to where Samuel was, this school of the prophets that Samuel had, and Saul sent messengers down there to get him. And they would come down there and just sort of fall under the spell of the place. And the next thing you know, they were joining in with the singing and everything. And so finally, Saul came down there himself. And, verse 23, when he did, God began to influence him, and he took off his armor. That's really what it means in verse 24. And began. This term prophesy can refer to singing, which I think under the context it does. You know, Saul came down there and just sort of so God blocked this demon out from being able to influence him, and just... the next thing, Saul just sort of fell under the spell of the place, and he took off his armor and his royal robes, and he just sort of joined in and was all caught up in things. And so the sort of the saying went around, "Is Saul among the prophets? You know, he's getting ready to start preaching here before long." Well, that just solved the problem for a little bit. David knew that he better get out of there. So here, David, we don't know, but as you put the story together, the indication is from the time of the slaying of Goliath until David fled is probably no more than 3 to 4 years, perhaps. Maybe between the ages of 18 and 22, something of that neighborhood. I don't know of any way to just nail it exactly, but just from the length of the accounts, we find that it didn't last long. And so Saul, David fled, and he came before Jonathan and tried to talk to Jonathan about it. Jonathan was going to try to help him out, but when Jonathan went to talk to his father and try to talk some sense into his father flew into a rage and said some very ugly things to him. And so Jonathan had arranged a signal with David, and they met out in the field away from anybody and made a covenant with one another as to what would happen. All this account is given here in chapter 20, that Jonathan, when you put a couple of the Notice what Saul said to Jonathan in verse 31 of chapter 20. As long as the son of Jesse lives upon the ground, you shall not be established nor your kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. See, Saul sought to play on Jonathan with the same things that he had. He said, don't you realize you'll never be king if this man lives? Don't you realize what he's doing? Well, you know, Jonathan had a totally different attitude. And and David had made a covenant saying that they would always take care of one another's family. And Jonathan was aware that, Jonathan was not jealous. He was a very selfless friend. If David was slated to be king, well, that was great. He was glad for it. Did not have that same jealousy and insecurity that so characterized Saul. That's a rare quality, you know, someone that is enough of a friend that they're willing to take second place and they delight in seeing their friend advance. That's something that is unusual. Well, in 1 Samuel 21, David, when he left, realized that if you go back and you put the account together, is the fact that Ahimelech was actually the descendant of Eli. Eli had a grandson that was born at the time when the Philistines took the ark, and his name was Ichabod, and Ahimelech is descended here from Ichabod, and that as you put the story here, that this is described here in back in 1 Samuel 14. This would be this was a descendant here of this family. Now, you remember the promise had been made that Eli's family would cease being, that the high priesthood would cease to come down in Eli's family. Well, it did. This event was precipitated. David had come to Nob, where the priests were, and had secured some food, and then had gone on. Well, there was a servant of Saul, the chief of his herdsmen, a man by the name of Doeg the Edomite. He was there and saw all of this. So David, verse 10, arose and fled that day for fear of Saul. And he went to Achish, king of Gath. And as the story comes on down, a little later we find that when Saul found out that the priest had been helpful to David, he actually was responsible for having Doeg murder the priests there at Nob. And that ended that was the blow that came on Eli's family that had been prophesied of. Now David went to Achish, king of Gath, but there was a problem. When he got there, see, he thought, well, I'm fleeing from Saul, so I'll go to the enemies of Saul. And, the enemy of my enemy will be my friend. Well, Achish was very suspicious. David, after all, had been the great hero of Israel. He's the one that slaughtered Philistines going and coming. And Achish didn't really believe. He thought this was some sort of a plot. He was very suspicious. And David got down there, and all of a sudden he realized Gath was not a good place to be. So he changed his behavior, verse 13, before Achish, began to act like he was nuts. And, he did this around for a little while, and Achish thought, this guy is crazy. I don't need any more crazy people around here. Get him away from me. And so David got away. Well, he departed, verse 22, and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And his brethren and all his father's house heard it, and they went down to him. By this time, Saul had evidently started persecuting and causing trouble for the family. And not only did they come down to him, verse 2, but everyone that was in distress and everyone that was in debt and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves together unto him, and he became a captain over them. Got to be about 400 men. Well, this was quite a crowd he had. You know, everybody that was down and out in trouble decided that they would go, they would go join up. And for some of them, perhaps it represented a fresh start, and they made changes in their life. I suspect many of them just stuck around for a little while, and they were malcontents when they came, and after the new wore off, they were malcontents again, and they went on down the road. We've seen things sort of like that in church sometimes, and this verse is sort of descriptive. But for a while they were there, and they were helpful, and various things happened. And out of those that came, some of the mighty men, some went on to become David's mighty men. And so David was sort of went from place to place, and Saul would chase after him. And Saul became increasingly obsessed with what David was doing, and he was spending increasing time doing this. Well, in 1 Samuel 22, we read when Doeg got his opportunity, he told Saul about having seen David and the Ahimelech, who was the priest there, and all of those that were with him. So the king brought them there and had Doeg murder them. Doeg slew the priests, and there were about 85 people that were slain. And there was one individual who got away, Abithar, and he fled to David. Well, David is on the run during this period of years. And as the story comes on, you read here in chapter 23, and we see David was all of these things were continuing to go on. In verse 19 of chapter 23, the Ziphites came to Saul and said, David's hiding himself in a stronghold in the woods. And so Saul was delighted. Now he found out where he was. And verse 25, he and his men went to seek him. They were chasing after David. And when David found out, well, he fled somewhere else, and Saul heard that. Verse 25, and he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. And so the situation went on and on. David dwelt in the strongholds of En-Gedi, verse 29. And after Saul had gotten back, chapter 24, verse 1, somebody told him, well, David's in the wilderness of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 men, and he went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. Saul was just absolutely obsessed with David. He couldn't even be king. He was out chasing David. He knew David was all of his problems came from David. If he could get rid of David, he wouldn't have any problems. You ever known people that way? All the problems are because of so-and-so. David wasn't Saul's problem. Saul was Saul's problem. But Saul is, I think, perhaps the most tragic story in the Bible. We're given the insight of this man who begins to deteriorate. You can just see his very sanity began to crumble as he became increasingly fearful and insecure and jealous and filled with resentment and just obsessed. And so he finally got out there, and David try to put a stop to it. David had had the opportunity. Saul actually came into a cave there to relieve himself, and it happened to be the one David was hiding in. And Saul had taken off his long robe and sort of laid it down, got in the cave and it was dark, and laid the robe down and went on back into a corner of the cave. And so David cut off the skirt of the robe. And Saul came back and he grabbed his robe and put it on. And he didn't notice it was dark in the cave, but when he got outside, of course, he was going to look ridiculous, have this robe that had been sliced off. Well, in the meantime, David began to feel terrible about it. He thought, I humiliated the king of Israel. And so David came out and bowed down to the ground and said, "Look, king, why do you think that I'm out to hurt you? I could have killed you in here, and I didn't. And I'll not put forth my hand against my Lord. He's the Lord's anointed." This is the end of verse 10. So, anyway, Saul, of course, he was sorry, and he was going to do better, and he wouldn't do that anymore, and you're more righteous than I am, verse 17. So, anyway, they made their agreement, and Saul went home, verse 22. But David and his men got up into the hold. He knew that Saul was not a fellow that could be trusted. Samuel died, and Israel gathered together, lamented him, and buried him in Ramah. And now we come to the story of Nabal. Nabal was well named. His name meant fool, and he was. He was a very sort of a churlish sort of fella. That's what we're told here. David had heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, and he sent 10 young men and said, "Go down and greet Nabal and ask him, wish him well, and ask him if he'll send us some food." There have been a lot of marauding bands and raiders and bandits and all of this sort of thing that's been going on, and we've protected his flock. No harm has come to anything. We haven't stolen anything. We haven't let any of these bandit raiders come in and do damage. We have watched out for him. And, we'd like him to send us, appreciate if he'd send us something to eat. Well, Nabal had some smart aleck sort of answer, just very insulting in what he said. And when the message was brought back to David, he was furious. Couldn't believe. Who does this guy think he is? So David said, "Look, get your swords on. We're going to go down there. I'm going to teach that fellow a lesson. There's no reason for anybody to be as ugly as he's acting." And word got to Abigail, Nabal's wife. And they told, even the servants, they knew how Nabal was. And they said, "Look, he's really done it this time. He sent back this insulting reply, and no telling what's going to happen." He said, "These men came down to salute our master," verse 14, "and he railed on." He just began to yell and scream and accuse and say all sorts of vile things. "The men were very good unto us, and we weren't hurt. Neither missed we anything as long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields. They were a wall unto us, both by night and day." And we know our master, he's a regular son of Belial. He's a son of the devil. No man can speak to him. You can't talk any sense to him. It's not going to do any good for any of us to try to tell him. He's just... So Abigail made haste, and she got some food together and brought it down to David. And she didn't say anything to Nabal, but was very respectful to David and calmed him down and said, "Look, you don't want to go down and do something like this in a fit of temper." And David, of course, in the aftermath, was very thankful that he hadn't, but he had lost his temper and gotten upset. So the result was, verse 36, "Abigail came to Nabal, and he was holding a feast in the house like a feast of a king. Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunken." So now you see part of Nabal's problem. He was probably tanked up good deal of the time. And he was very drunken this time, more than just his ordinary run-of-the-mill kind of drunken. And so she didn't tell him anything until the next day. And after he'd sort of sobered up the next day, she told him what had happened. And he just had a heart attack. Boom, he was gone. And so word came to David about it, and he heard what had happened. And once a little time had passed, he asked Abigail to come down and propose marriage to her. And so she became his wife. Saul had, in the meantime, had taken David's wife, Michal, and given her to somebody else. Well, the story continues on here in David was hiding himself, and the Ziphites came and told Saul. And again, you have the story. David could have killed Saul. Came down there, and he could have killed him, but he didn't. And Saul said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I won't do it again." And David knew. Saul returned to his place, and David said, chapter 27, verse 1, "I'm going to perish one day by the hand of Saul. I better get down to the land of the Philistines. And so David arose and went down there. Now, by this time, see, several years have passed. And so he comes down to Achish. And now he's received quite differently. Because now they recognize that David and Saul really are enemies. It's not a trick. And David comes down there and says, "Look, I've got a price on my head in Israel. I'll come down here and I'll work for you." So the story went on. You see, David was sort of a like mercenary troops there for the Philistines, and we. As we come on down, there were problems that were continuing to go between the Philistines and Israel. And after Samuel had died, verse 3, and he was buried, Saul, verse 5, saw the host of the Philistines, and he was afraid. His heart greatly trembled. It's interesting if you go through the number of times and read how Saul was afraid. But you see, in Saul's fear, he never went to God. Not really. You can go back and read in the Psalms. David had to face fear too. David wrestled with his fears. But David said, "What time I am afraid, I will trust in you." See, David's fears caused him to draw close to God for help. Saul had gotten further and further away from God, was more obsessed. Now, when Saul was in trouble and the Philistines had come down, he inquired of the Lord, and you know, he and God hadn't been on speaking terms for quite a while. And so, sure enough, he didn't get an answer. So then Saul decided, you know, what's his solution? Is it to fast and pray and repent? No. He says, "Well, God won't tell me the answer. I know where I'll go. I'll go down, I'll get a witch. And she'll be, you know, I'll get me this fortune teller, and she'll tell me what's going on." You see, Saul never could get the point. So anyway, he came on down, and the story, he asked her to bring up Samuel. And then she realized after this that this was Saul, this was the king. And she thought he was playing a trick on her because, see, earlier there had been witches and fortune-telling, all that sort of thing had been outlawed in Israel. But Saul evidently knew where to find one when he needed it. Because he comes down there. And now, she saw the vision. Saul didn't. He asks her, what did she see? What did it look like? He said, or she told him in verse 14, an old man coming up. He's covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. That's what Saul figured out. In reality, it was a demon spirit masquerading. It's just sort of like these fortune tellers or seances or something like that. But in those days, they did not have the idea of the immortal souls floating around. So what she saw was like a pseudo-resurrection. She saw this, somebody coming up out of the ground. And Saul jumped to the conclusion that it was Samuel. And He said, look, I'm really afraid. I'm sore distressed. The Philistines make war against me, and God's departed from me. And I thought, well, I'd talk to you. You were always helpful to me. And Saul said, well, what are you asking me for? Or Samuel, you know, the Spirit told him, said, well, if God's departed from you and has become your enemy, what good do you think it's going to do to ask me? And the Lord has rent the kingdom out of your hand, given it to your neighbor, even to David. And so Saul fell down straightway on the earth, verse 20. He was sore afraid, and there was no strength in him. He hadn't eaten anything. And so the woman, they made him some, gave him some food, gave him a little bread, and she fixed up some food and brought it, and Saul ate. Well, verse 29, the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and Israel pitched by the fountain, which is in Jezreel. And David and his men were there in the rear with Achish. But the princes of the Philistines were suspicious of them, and they didn't want them around. There got to be some conflict, and David, Achish told David, said, look, the others don't want you out here when we're going to go to war with Israel. And so David and his men rose and departed, verse 11. The Philistines went up to Jezreel. And David and his men came to Ziklag and found out that the Amalekites had invaded and burned the place and taken all the families captive. So David was greatly distressed, and everybody was all upset. They had been gone. But notice here, verse 6, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. You know, they were blaming David. They said, here you were, and you, all of us were gone, and here are all of our families, and they've been taken captive, and we'll never see them again. Notice what? David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. See, when David was beset with this terrible calamity, he didn't know what to do. He sought God and really began to draw close to God. And David told Abiathar the priest to come and come with him and bring the ephod and to inquire of God. And God revealed what David was to do, and they found the Amalekites. As the as you come on down through the story, verse 17, David smote them from twilight even unto the evening of the next day, and there escaped not a man of them, except 400 young men which rode upon camels and fled. And David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, including his wives, and there was nothing lacking, none of the sons or daughters or spoil or anything. So everything was recovered back. And as we come on down, that David and the men, verse 26, came back to Ziklag. And they sent of the spoil to the elders of Judah. This is verse 26. And he sent presents out to those in Bethel and south Ramoth and various other places, including Hebron. And so chapter 31 tells us that the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and they slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle was sore against Saul. The archers hit him. He was wounded. And he asked his armor-bearer to finish him off, but the armor bearer was afraid. He wouldn't do that. So Saul took a sword and fell upon it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he committed suicide as well. And Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and his men. And the Philistines came the next day, verse 8, to strip the dead, and they found that Saul and his three sons were fallen. And they cut off his head and stripped his armor and put it up there in their idol's temple. And the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, verse 11, heard what the Philistines had done. And their valiant men arose and went that night and took the body of Saul and the body of his sons from the walls of Bethshean and came to Jabesh and burnt them there and took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh. So it's interesting, you know, the beginning, this account is told. It's told to their credit, and David later had great praise for them. It's interesting how some people have very much of a concept of loyalty. If you go back to the beginning of the story of Saul, really at the beginning of his kingship, the event that was really the brightest spot in Saul's kingship was very early on, when these Canaanite raiders were threatening to mutilate and kill a lot of the people in Jabesh Gilead, and they were going to destroy the city and make slaves of all the people. And Saul put together an army and came up and delivered them. And that was really the first thing of note, the first thing of consequence he did as king. And so the people of Jabesh Gilead, you know, Saul may have gone off the deep end, become a lot of things, but he was always a hero in Jabesh Gilead. He had rescued them. He had saved them from a terrible fate. And when Saul was killed and his body was mutilated and was hung up there to be, gawked at, that sort of thing is not an ancient custom. After all, that's what the partisans did to Mussolini right at the end of World War II, you know, when they killed him. And that's what the Philistines had done to Saul. Hung him up there to just for everybody to sort of gawk at, him and his sons. Well, these men from Jabesh Gilead came down there, sneaked down there at night, cut him down, and hauled them back to Jabesh Gilead to bury them. So it later, when David became aware of that, he was very, very positive toward those people. The what we're told that the account in First Chronicles is. Really just tells the death of King Saul. And we're told in verse 13, Saul died for his transgression which he committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord which he kept not, and also for asking counsel of one that had a familiar spirit to inquire of it. He inquired not of the Lord, therefore he slew him and turned his kingdom unto David the son of Jesse. You see, this was sort of the crowning event for Saul. But he died for his transgressions. Saul wouldn't listen. And he wouldn't do the things that God had instructed him to do. But I think as we go through this section and are introduced to David, we find that David evidenced tremendous faith. We see it early on. In carrying out his responsibilities as a shepherd. We find it in going out to face Goliath. We find it later that God tested him on his faith and his loyalty. Now, on two specific occasions, he had the opportunity to, quote, solve his problems, kill Saul. And his friends were standing there saying, look, God's delivered him into your hands. Go ahead and finish him off. And David wouldn't do it. He trusted God. He said, no, God will do it his way. I won't lift up my hand against the Lord's anointed. You know, David evidenced faith and loyalty. David evidenced courage. And he had an opportunity to deepen this matter of patient faith in trusting God to resolve the problems his way. You know, David was tried and tested on that. And this is a good section as we go through and we meditate on the characteristics of David, what it was that God was so pleased with. Why was God so pleased and satisfied that David was a man after his own heart? Because he saw qualities of courage, qualities of loyalty, qualities of faith that were deepened and refined, qualities that David had as of mercy and of compassion, of taking his responsibilities very, very seriously. All of these things that it's interesting along this line to go back to some of the Psalms that were written during the time of these events. There are, in the Psalms, you'll read certain ones that were written when David was hiding from Saul in the cave of Adullam, when he fled from Saul here or there, when he found himself before Achish there in Gath. And you read of these things and you find what was going on in David's mind. And what he was working through, you see, God allowed him to go through those trials and tests because God was refining the character that he had and was preparing David not only to be king over Israel for 40 years, but preparing him most of all to be king over all of Israel forever. Well, that concludes the portion that we're covering here this evening, and I have study questions on the next Bible study, which we will pick up the story in 2 Samuel next time.